Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo
Kuntyuvacha
Namasye
Purusham Tvadyam Ishwaram Prakritik Param Alakshyam Sarvabhutanam Antar Bahir Avastitam Kuntyuvacha Namasye Purusham Tvadyam Ishwaram Prakritik Param Alakshyam Sarvabhutanam Antar Purusham Tvadyam Ishwaram Prakritik Param Alakshyam Sarvabhutanam Antar Bahir Avastitam Kuntyuvacha Namasye Purusham Tvadyam Alakshyam Sarvabhutanam Antar Bahir Avastitam Namasye Purusham Tvadyam Alakshyam Sarvabhutanam Antar Bahir Avastitam Kunti Uvacha. Srimati Kunti said, Namasye, let me bow down. Purusham, the Supreme Person. Tva. You, Adyam, the original, Ishwaram, the controller, Prakriti, of the material cosmos, Param, beyond, Alakshyam, the invisible. Sarva, all Bhutanam of living beings, Antaha, within, Bahihi, without, Avastitam, existing. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srimati Kunti said, O Krishna, I offer my obeisances unto you because you are the original personality and are unaffected by the qualities of the material world. You are existing both within and without everything, and yet you are invisible to all. Purport. Srimati Kunti Devi was quite aware that Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. Although he was playing the part of her nephew, such an enlightened lady could not commit a mistake by offering obeisances unto her nephew. Therefore, she addressed him as the, there would be a mistake, my dear nephew. Yeah, little Krishna, obeisance, that's not the right mood. So she has to treat him like the Supreme Lord. I'm sorry. Therefore, she addressed him as the original Purusha, beyond the material cosmos. Although all living entities are also transcendental, they are neither original nor infallible. The living entities are apt to fall down under the clutches of material nature. This is another of Prabhupada's favorite words, clutches, snares, clutches. He likes these words, poetic words. Under the clutches of material nature. But the Lord is never like that. The Lord is never like that. He doesn't fall under those clutches. In the Vedas, therefore, he is described as the chief among all living entities. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam. Then again, he is addressed as Ishwara, or the controller. The living entities, or the demigods like Chandra and Surya, are also to some extent Ishwara, but none of them is the supreme Ishwara, or the ultimate controller. He is the Parama Ishwara, or the Supersoul. He is both within and without. Although he was present before Srimati Kunti Devi as her nephew, he was also within her and everyone else. In the Bhagavad Gita 15:15, the Lord says, I am situated in everyone's heart, and only due to me one remembers, forgets, and is cognizant, etc. Through all the Vedas I am to be known, because I am the compiler of the Vedas, and I am the teacher of the Vedanta. Queen Kunti affirms that the Lord, although both within and without all living beings, is still invisible. The Lord is, so to speak, a puzzle for the common man. Queen Kunti experienced personally that Lord Krishna was present before her. Yet he entered within the womb of Uttara to save her embryo from the attack of Ashwatthama's Brahmastra. Kunti herself was puzzled about whether Sri Krishna is all-pervasive or localized. In fact, he's both. But he reserves the right of not being exposed to persons who are not surrendered souls. This checking curtain is called the Maya energy of the Supreme Lord, and it controls the limited vision of the rebellious soul. It is explained as follows. A few prayers have been offered to Krishna in the previous chapters. Krishna appeared in chapter 7, and Arjuna offered a short prayer, 4 verses. And in the beginning of this chapter, Uttara offered a 2-verse prayer. Minor prayers, not minor, but short. Here's the first major set of prayers in the whole Bhagavatam, at least addressed to Krishna himself. This is a big event. First major prayer is offered to Krishna, and there are many other prayers that will be offered by so many different devotees and demigods later on in the Bhagavatam. But who comes first? Kunti. She's no demigod. She's not a Brahmin. She's a woman. But she gets first billing. She comes first. And her prayers are very outstanding, even among all the other prayers in the Bhagavatam. Prabhupada wrote a book just to present these prayers with the classes he gave on them. He had it published as a book, separately. Prayers of Queen Kunti. She has very special qualification to be offering Krishna prayers. She's a very expert, very competent offerer of prayers to Krishna. So many people try to offer prayers, but she's among the best. To properly offer prayers to Krishna, you have to have at least two major qualifications which aren't always compatible. You don't always find them in the same person. You have to be very knowledgeable about Krishna. You have to be able to say all the right things and not say anything wrong. You have to know who he is and what he is. In other words, you have to be expert in Vedanta philosophy to properly offer prayers to Krishna. And second of all, you have to have a personal relationship with him. Strangers, just people with no close relationship with Krishna, cannot really offer the best prayers. You should know him theoretically, and you should have a personal connection. So Kunti certainly has an intimate personal connection with Krishna, as has been discussed in the previous classes. In one sense, she's even closer to Krishna than Krishna's own mother, Devaki, because Kunti didn't have her husband to protect her anymore. She was totally helpless and dependent on Krishna, and that made her dependence on him very, very intense and complete. Therefore, Krishna reciprocated with her accordingly and was always available. Whenever the Pandavas under her care were in danger, when she prayed, he would immediately appear and save them. Vipadak santutak shashvad tatra tatra jagat guru vavato darshanam yat syad apunar bhavadarshanam. She's going to pray that let these calamities happen again and again. Who wants calamities? Who asks for them? We get enough calamities without asking for more. So most of us are asking, we're praying to God sincerely, and we're saying, please, enough calamities, no more. That's our prayer. Spare me from calamities, please. You know, I have a hard enough time just living from day to day. I don't need calamities. But Kunti is praying, please send us more. And she's talking about real danger. The whole power of the dynasty, the king and his son, Duryodhan, are dead set on destroying the Pandavas whom she is supposed to be protecting. So they're exposed to terrible danger, and so many attempts were made on their lives. But she's praying, Krishna, please send more of this. More of this danger. Because whenever we're in a helpless situation, you appear to us and you save us. Of course, Krishna didn't always physically appear, but he always saved Kunti and the Pandavas by his personal arrangements. So she has that very intimate service relationship with Krishna. Even though she's an elder, and therefore is in a socially superior position, but she's feeling very much dependent on Krishna, that he's their protector. She's not thinking herself Krishna's protector. Although she does take advantage of her superior, senior position, and she's not shy to complain to Krishna about their problems. She is good at complaining to Krishna, and she's not shy to do it. So she does exercise her seniority in that regard. But still, she always thinks herself completely subordinate and dependent on Krishna, that only with Krishna's protection can they even survive. in the face of such danger. That is there. And we see in this very first prayer that somehow or other, she never went to school. She was living in, you know, as a pampered princess in the palace. And maybe she got some tutoring there, but I don't think she studied Vedanta. They don't usually teach the princesses Vedanta. Maybe Bhagavad Gita or something. Yeah. But she knows it. By virtue of her devotion, she is the most expert Vedantist. She has it exactly right. That even though, you know, Krishna is her nephew, it's not appropriate to start off the prayers, you know, my dear nephew, I shower you with my blessings. That's not how to start the prayers. That's not prayers. That's just the opposite. So she has to switch the roles and let Krishna be God, at least for the sake of the duration of the first few prayers. And therefore she's addressing him as such. The primeval, original person. So many people are there. So many people are there now, such a big family. The Kurus and the Vrishnis, how many are there? Billions of them. So many persons. And they come from long dynasties of many generations. Kings, so many famous kings. We read about them in the Bhagavatam. So many generations of these dynasties. So how many persons is Kunti dealing with, past and present? But Krishna is the supreme person, Adyam Purusham, the one who came before everybody else. Here's a paradox, that Krishna is younger than Kunti. He appeared after she did. He appeared in the 59th generation after Lord Brahma, if you count the genealogy. In the dynasty of the sun god, rather the moon god. But she recognizes and identifies immediately, you're the original person, you came first. You were born, or not born, you were there before anybody was born. Ishwaram, Supreme Controller. What's the suffix here? This is Tadita Prakaranam, but Vada, where does Vada come from? Vada is a it's a Kridanta, okay, but it's a Vedic form. It's rare, the suffix vara. We have nashvara, subject to destruction, prone to getting destroyed. And ishvara, what the vara suffix means, prone to controlling, or, you know, having the tendency to control. And nashvara is having the tendency to be destroyed. And anything else? A few other words with vara. Controls well, that's what it really means. Okay, so nashra means it gets destroyed well. Anyway, and there's two or three maybe other words in the language with vara suffix. It's rare, and it's Vedic. It's an archaic suffix. That is there in the word Ishvara, a very common word. We still use the word. Anybody can be a controller to some extent. But he's the Ishvara who is Prakritek Param. All the other Ishvaras are, well, all the Jivas who are Ishvaras, all the conditioned Jivas who are Ishvaras are under the control of material nature. The liberated Jivas can also be Ishvaras. They might be spiritual masters. They might be kings, Vajarshis. And they may be liberated, which makes them free from the subordination to Maya. But they're not controller of Maya. Only the Supreme Lord is controller of Maya. He is the Parameshwara. The subordinate, everyone else is just a subordinate Ishwara in his own scope, his own range of control. And everybody has some control. Even the beggar in the street, who no one gives any serious regard to, he controls his own body. He can wiggle his finger. He's in control of it. He has some little amount of control. After a day of begging, he has 20, maybe 100 rupees. Actually, here in Govardhan, begging is a good profession. You can, on a busy day, all you have to do is sit there. And especially if you put Gaudiya Vaishnava Tilak on, you can easily collect 300 rupees just sitting there on a busy day. That's why so many people come from outside, or even some of the locals. They're not really beggars, but they turn beggar on the busy days just to get some pocket change. But even the beggar who may have a few rupees at the end of the day, it's his choice. Will he spend it on tea or cigarettes or, buy some bacon or what? He can choose what to do with his money. So he's a controller also. Everybody's a controller. The dog can decide who to bark at. Everybody has some control. Everybody's Ishwara. But Kunti is correctly identifying Krishna as the one Ishwara who is the dominator of Prakriti. Alakshyam sarvabhutanam. Okay, that's in the last sentence in Prabhupada's translation, that he's invisible to everybody. That's another paradox. She's talking to him face to face and telling him he's invisible. But on the theoretical level, yes. To most everybody, he's invisible. Only a very privileged few get to see him face to face. We may, in India, almost everybody has seen or has on his wall a picture of Krishna. But that's a picture. Who has Krishna sitting in his living room, visiting him? Very few people. Queen Kunti did. Krishna was in her living room as her guest so many times. So when she says he's invisible, she means something special by that. He can be visible, but only to his pure devotees. To everybody else, he's invisible, even though he is everywhere. In the material world, we demarcate inside and outside. We put walls around our property, around the plot of our house, and that's the inside. Trespassers will be shot. Beware the dog if you come over the fence, because that's the inside. It doesn't belong to you. It belongs to me. Touch you, if I come within 1.5 feet of you, you become defensive. And if I come a little too close, you're ready to punch me in the face. This is the defense zone. You can't, if you violate someone's personal space, then you're threatening, and you may be, a person may defend himself against you. That's inside and outside. It's demarcating. Demarcating everything in the material world, especially in terms of what belongs to whom. But Krishna, he's Vasudeva. You can understand the word Vasudeva. It does have meanings, so it's not just Rudhi. It's also, Vasudeva can be understood by yoga, by its derivation. Vasu means to dwell. It also means property as a noun. So, Lord Vasudev dwells everywhere. Vastatu, vasati, sarvatra vasati, iti vasudeva. I don't know if that's there in the sutras, something like that. But anyway, that explanation is given in commentaries. He lives everywhere, inside and outside. No matter where people put their walls around their egos and around their houses and around their countries, Krishna is both inside and outside. He doesn't care what belongs to whom because of the other meaning of Vasudeva. Vasu means property. Vasudeva means everything is his property. It all belongs to him, no matter what walls other people put up, boundary walls. Krishna can ignore them because everything belongs to him. So he's inside and outside of everything. And still, hardly anyone is able to see him. So this is very apt identification of Krishna as the absolute truth, the personality of Godhead. This is just the beginning of the prayers, but she's starting off on the right foot. She has had so many discussions with Krishna previously. She has talked to Krishna so many times, hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times. But this is something different. Now she's offering serious prayers. And she marks that by this first verse, saying, I'm not addressing you now as my nephew. I am addressing you as the absolute truth. And then you may also be my nephew. But first of all, I'm making it clear that I'm approaching you as your eternal servant, and you are the absolute truth. Hare Krishna. So, have questions or comments? Yes.
So, când Kunti și ofrist prayers, we pedal sunt tatăl și tatăl tatăl jegat guru, she is asking for calamities. Is it necessary to be able to remember Krishna and be surrendered to him to be in dangerous situation, or we can do it in normal situation as well?
If Krishna arranges that, yes. Some devotees don't have to be in dangerous situations. Other ones, Krishna arranges for danger. Some of us have to be put through difficult situations for purification. Maybe danger or just anxiety or helplessness. It doesn't have to be. We can be put into anxiety very easily without serious danger. This is the danger of missing a meal. You know, that's enough to put us into a panic. Krishna is economical. His Maya energy is economical. You know, if you can be attracted by an ugly woman, why should Maya send a beautiful woman? Should they send an ugly woman to attract you? And also the spiritual energy. If she can bring you to Krishna with a less expensive energy, more economical, she'll do it. So if just some mental anxiety that has no real basis is enough to force you to surrender, that's good enough. There's no need for real danger. But some devotees have to be, they've got a lot of conditioning and they have to be put into real danger so that they're forced to be helpless. They're stubborn, they're not cooperating, they don't want to be helpless. So sometimes the transcendental energy of the Lord arranges for real danger to make the devotee surrender or really push them. Never force, but to give them a real good opportunity to surrender. And then, among the liberated devotees, it depends on the relationship. So some devotees can become free, can become purified without actually having to be in dangerous situations. Others, Krishna's divine energy decides that some more serious treatment is required. And among the liberated devotees, some of them seem to be in great apparent danger. Immediate danger of annihilation, destruction. And it's part of their loving relationship with the Lord and the pastimes they participate in. some devotees. Others, there's no such thing for them. You know, life is easy, no problems, and it's just enjoy with Krishna. It depends on the individual relationship. This is on the liberated level. But there, the danger is only apparent. If you're actually fully under Krishna's protection, there is no danger. There may be a false show of danger, and everyone else may be terrified. As when Kaliya seemed to be killing Krishna, and all the cows were dead, and the coward boys who drank the water were dead, and it looks like Krishna's on the verge of being killed. So that looked like a very dangerous situation. But that was just a show. There was no danger. Krishna can't be killed, and he brought the cows and the boys back to life. There was no real danger. And so on the spiritual level, among the pure devotees who are enjoying loving relationships with Krishna, there is no real danger, just sometimes a false appearance of such.
So in this connection, what should be our prayer? Shall we also, as Queen Kunti does, pray for calamities, or we have to pray?
Well, we can repeat her prayers, and just with the mentality, I'm not Kunti, but I'm repeating her prayers. Because if you want to ask for calamities, make sure that's what you want first. Yeah. If you ask for it seriously, you may get it. Do you want it?
Well, we should just ask Krishna to send us whatever he wants us for purification, for spiritual progress.
That's the safest thing, rather than ask for something we can't handle. Let Krishna decide what to send.
Thank you.
Unless you have an advanced relationship and you just know that the Krishna, you know, is supposed to send you calamities, then you can ask for them. But, you know, make sure that's what you need and want. Okay. Anything else? Damodar? Gopal Baba?
It's a technical thing. I remember reading the Nectar of Devotion of the 64 qualities of Krishna. I think it's all pervasive. I think it's all pervasive in the Nectar of Devotion, that quality. Yeah. And they give the example that Krishna was simultaneously accepting the prayers of Kunti and in the womb of Uttara saving the child.
Yes.
But it just seems from the Bhagavatam verses that it's like it goes in the flow. It's, okay, he saves the child and then...
Okay, but that statement is there that it was simultaneous. So maybe, you know, he couldn't immediately leave. I mean, maybe he had to stay in the womb for a little while after he drove away the monster weapon. Just like, you know, remember that we're told that actually Pariksha's body was destroyed and Krishna brought him back to life. So if someone experiences a near-death experience, you know, and the medics get him, you know, and they resuscitate him, it's not that they're going to immediately drop him on the street. They'll take him to the hospital for a few days of rest and observation. The person almost died. So Pariksha just almost died, or actually did die and was brought back to life. So Krishna maybe is staying around in the womb for a little while to watch that he's okay. Maybe.
Like it says in text 17, thus save from the radiation of the Brahmastu Kunti, the chaste devotee of the Lord, and her five sons, and Draupadi addressed Lord Krishna as he started for home.
Is that so, and only after that did Kunti begin her prayers. But you said that we're told in the Nectar of Devotion that both things were going on at the same time. She was offering her prayers, and Krishna was in Uttara's womb, right?
Yeah.
So that's something I try to... Maybe that's an explanation how it could have been.
Krishna is about to leave. This is like the farewell party. And then the Brahmastra comes.
But after they were saved from the Brahmastra...
The situation of the first Brahmastra came was while he was leaving. Then the Brahmastra came.
Yeah, second one.
Then the Brahmastra came... And he saved the Pandavas because there was some...
And, yeah, there was...
There's some directed towards the Pandavas. And
I don't know if it's five Brahmastras. There's five weapons and a Brahmastra sent to kill Parikshit all at the same time. Six weapons.
So he saved them, the Pandavas.
And then saved the you know, then drove away the Brahmastra weapon in the womb.
While he was still doing that, she was offering prayers. She was offering prayers to him.
Maybe.
Because there was like the external Brahmastra and like the internal one.
Okay. Okay, it could be like that.
Okay, thank you.
But I would think that Kunti would not start offering her prayers until it was clear that the danger was over. I don't know what indication they had of that. You know, the rest of them couldn't see inside the womb to see if the embryo was alive or dead. So I don't know, maybe some Krishna or some Vyasadeva or someone told them it's okay. I don't know how they found out that the danger is over. Now we can offer our prayers. You know, but I would presume that they got a sense, they got the idea that the danger is over, and then Kunti offered her prayers. Because that's what it said. The verse says, Brahma Teja Vinya Muktai, having been released from the danger of the Brahmastra weapon. How did they know they were released? Somebody told them. Somehow they found out. And then Queen Kunti offered the prayers.
Brahma Tejo Vinaya Mukta, that's addressing the Pandavas, but Parikshit is not mentioned, so it's still happening in Parikshit's womb or something.
Okay, it says that the Pandavas being released. Okay, so maybe Parikshit was still in the process of being saved. I guess so. That could be. Yeah. Do you have something?
I also heard that in Nectar Devotion it's explained there's a list of top 10 Vatsalya devotees. Yes. In that she occupies 6th or 7th position.
6th or 7th, yes.
Yeah, after Yashoda, Nanda Maharaj, Devaki and this. Yes. So, where does she stand if we have to compare the mothers in Dwaraka, in Mathura and in Vrindavan? So this Hastinapur, where does it come in picture, in the connection?
Well, you can consider Hastinapur an extension of Dwarka. The kind of relationship Krishna has with the Pandavas is similar to the relationships he has with the Vrishnis. It's on the same basic level. So there are three abodes, not 7 or 10. Even though Krishna visited other places too, he visited Mithila, so many places he visited. But there's only three basic abodes. So any of the extra places should be considered like annexes of those three abodes. And it's natural to connect Hastinapur with Dwarka. So basically, whatever devotees are in Hastinapur are basically on the same level as the Dwarka devotees. And then you have to judge each one of them individually. According to the individual relationships, that one is greater than another, not according to which place he lives. Okay, so basically, Hastinapur is equivalent to Dwarka, and which devotees are better, that's individual. Okay, so we should stop here. Thank you. Om Glory to Srila Prabhupada, Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.